back again to read Hitler's War by David Irving. Let Europe hold its breath. Hitler entered the new year, 1941, with two distantly related ambitions: to knock out Soviet Russia and thus force Britain to submit with no injury to her empire, and to rescue fascism in Italy from threatened oblivion. Through Admiral Canaris, he had offered, using obscure diplomatic channels, to mediate between Greece and Italy, but in vain. The fact is, for better or worse, Germany is tied to the Duce, explained Hitler on January 4th. In the long run, you can only make history through loyalty, he mused virtuously. In the Balkans, a dangerous situation had developed since Italy's ill-timed attack on Greece in October. Over Hitler's broad desks at the Berghof flowed the dispatches from Ribbentrop's experts. Familiar and unfamiliar Balkan potentates and diplomats were ushered past. In January, the Prime Minister of Bulgaria arrived, followed a week later by King Boris again, still promising to join the tripartite pact, but genuinely fearing that the Russians would invade the moment the Germans set foot in Bulgaria. Here, too, was Antonescu, reaffirming the Romanian willingness to fight for Hitler, but asking now for mines and for big guns to defend his Black Sea port of Constanta, where 700,000 tons of German oil was stockpiled, against Russian attack. No terrain could be less promising for modern armies than the Balkans. Before Hitler's troops could even get into Bulgaria, they would have to throw pontoon bridges across the swirling Danube River, nearly a mile wide. The roads were virtually impassable in winter, and became morasses when the snow thawed. The crumbling bridges crossing the countless Balkan streams and dikes would never support the loads an army would impose on them. Nevertheless, the Wehrmacht overcame all these obstacles. In the remaining weeks before Merida, German staff officers in plain clothes and Volkswagens were sent through Bulgaria to supervise the strengthening of the bridges and the resurfacing of the roads. To Hitler, early in 1941, the Balkans meant two things: the Ploiești oil field in Romania, and now well within the reach of the RAF bombers, even if the Athens government still refused them the necessary overflight permission, and Salonika in northern Greece, from which the Allies had launched their deadly assault on Austria-Hungary in World War I. He called together his leading military advisors and Ribbentrop for a council of war at the Berghof. It began on January 7th and ended on the 9th with a major secret speech in which he outlined the reasoning underlying his grand strategy. At a length and level of frankness unfamiliar since his harangues of 1939. People had overconfidently predicted, he remarked, that Britain would cave in under pressure of the Luftwaffe bombing offensive. Now, not even Hitler accepted that. The British people's toughness was a wholly unexpected factor, he admitted. Terror raids by the Luftwaffe have little point or prospect of success, he explained. The Luftwaffe must concentrate on reinforcing the naval blockade and on attacking bottlenecks in the arms industry. Britain was already admitting to a 10% loss in arms output. Rumors of Britain's growing military strength could easily be discounted by the simplest analysis of the raw materials position. At present, Germany was producing 24 million tons of iron a year, compared with the less than 8 million in Britain. Germany could marshal far greater reserves of manpower. In Britain, the number of jobless was actually increasing, a sure measure of her industrial problems. The German naval blockade was only just beginning. The destruction of the English mother country is inevitable in time, Hitler concluded. Britain is propped up by her faith in the United States and Russia. Her wooing of Stalin was betrayed by many clues. From intercepts, Hitler was aware of the diplomatic overtures Britain was preparing in Moscow. Britain had disclaimed any interest in the Dardanelles, and Russia's course of increased demands since the summer of 1940 was unlikely to be coincidence. Stalin was infinitely clever. He must be seen as an ice-cold blackmailer who would not hesitate to tear up every written treaty if it served his purposes. Apart from Russia, Germany's position was now impregnable, at least for the coming year, Hitler added. Norway was safe from invasion, Occupied France wanted an end to the war, and the unoccupied half still dreamed of a reverse in its fortunes. But he had prepared Operation Attila to occupy this sector should General Weygand, that German hater, declare North Africa for the Allies. He was still undecided about Spain. Franco had more than once broken his promise concerning Gibraltar, and he would still go no further than agree to enter the war once Britain was down and almost out. In the Balkans, only Romania was unreservedly friendly. Antonescu had made the best impression imaginable on Hitler. Bulgaria was loyal, had feared Russian intervention until recently, but would join the Tripartite Pact in good time. Hungary was usable at present. Yugoslavia was cool. Therefore, Russia must be Britain's last hope. They will only give up when we have smashed this last hope on the continent to smithereens. The British were no fools, said Hitler. They must realize that if they lost this war, they would no longer have the moral authority to hold their empire together. On the other hand, if they can pull through and raise 40 or 50 divisions, and if the United States and Russia help them, then Germany will be in a precarious situation. He had always believed, he said, in destroying the enemy's most powerful positions first. That is why Russia must now be defeated. True, the Russian forces are a clay colossus with no head, but who knows how they will develop in the future? The defeat of the Soviet Union must be swift and final. Under no circumstances must the Russians be allowed to regroup after the first brutal breakthrough. Again, he called for the rapid occupation of the Baltic coast, first of all. The general's strategic targets were the annihilation of the Russian army and the occupation of the oil fields at Baku on the Caspian Sea. Though immense and new, this latter demand should not, however, daunt them. Their armies had also covered immense distances in the few weeks of the French campaign. Hitler reminded them. He concluded, "When we fight this campaign, let Europe hold its breath." From now until June 1941, Hitler made no mention whatsoever of Russia in his public speeches. On January 5th, 1941, a small British force had captured the Italian fortress of Bardia in Libya, taking 45,000 Italians prisoner. God, those embarrassing losers. There were only now 5 Italian divisions left in Cyrenaica, and only 5 more in Tripolitania. Meanwhile, the Luftwaffe Corps, which Hitler had transferred to the Mediterranean, had opened its attack on January 6th, sinking a British cruiser and damaging an aircraft carrier. Hitler sought for other ways of helping the Italians out of their self-created mess, like sending a mountain division to Albania and a small blocking force of German tanks and engineers to help the Italians hold on to Tripoli. His ambassador in Rome accompanied Ribbentrop to the Berghof on the 9th and urged that Germany exert a greater influence on Italian strategy. But Hitler characteristically refused to do anything that would damage the Duce. 2 days later, he signed the directive ordering the army and Luftwaffe to prepare to support the Italian defense of Albania and Tripolitania. Mussolini finally agreed to come to a meeting, but stipulated that there must be no fuss and no photographers. Hitler collected him from a small railroad station near Salzburg at 10 a.m. on January 19th. 2 days of conferences and strolls about the snow-clad Ober-Salzburg followed. Hitler had one 90-minute talk privately with the Duce, but from the record of the other conferences, it is clear he revealed nothing he had not already stated to his own generals on the 9th, except that he made no mention of his plan to attack Russia soon. Indeed, he again averred that so long as the wise and prudent Stalin was alive, Russia would adhere to her treaties. This meeting brought to an end Mussolini's dream of fighting an independent war parallel to Hitler's in the Mediterranean. He accepted the offer of a blocking force for Tripoli, but could not accept the mountain divisions for Albania, as he needed the Albanian port space for his own reinforcements. His humiliations continued. On January 22nd, Tobruk fell into British hands with 25,000 Italians. The whole of Tripolitania was now in peril. the Panzer Specialist General Hans von Funk sent to North Africa in mid-January, reported to Hitler on February 1st in the most pessimistic terms at the Chancellery in Berlin. The Italians had no will to resist the British onslaught in North Africa. "The crazy feature is," said Hitler afterward to his staff, "that on the one hand, the Italians are shrieking for help, but on the other hand, they are so jealous and childish that they won't stand for being helped by German soldiers. Mussolini would probably like it best if our troops could fight in Italian uniforms there." In conference with his army and Luftwaffe chiefs 2 days later, Hitler again declared that militarily the loss of Italian North Africa would mean little. However, its political and psychological effects could be devastating. Hitler decided to send more than just a blocking force to North Africa. He would send a light infantry and a panzer division to Libya with a German corps staff. He chose Erwin Rommel to command this Africa Corps. In August 1942, he explained to Italy's ambassador Dino Alfieri, "I chose Rommel because he's like Dietl. He knows how to carry his troops forward with him, and this is absolutely vital for the commander of an army fighting under extremes of climate, be it in North Africa or in the far north." On February 6th, he briefed Rommel and General Enno von Rintelen, the military attaché in Rome, in Berlin. He instructed Rintelen to ask Mussolini to put all the Italian mechanized units in Libya under Rommel's command. Rommel was told to hold Tripolitania for the Axis powers, tying down the British and preventing them from breaking through to the French in Tunisia. Saw Army's commander-in-chief... What the hell is that? I wonder if this will make sense after I read it. Saw Army's commander-in-chief Brauchitsch first, wrote Rommel to his wife. Okay. Then the Führer. There is no time to be lost. My luggage is being sent on afterward. My head reels to think of all that can still go wrong. It will be months before things can take effect. His first troops began disembarking at Tripoli in North Africa on the 12th. Spurred on by the ambiguous attitude of Vichy during January 1941, Hitler put renewed pressure on General Franco to revise his views on Gibraltar. The British were certain, he argued, to let Spain down in the end. Franco, of course, had no inkling of the strict timetable Hitler had already drawn up. This explains the increasing irritability of Ribbentrop's telegrams to Madrid over the next 2 weeks. On the 20th, the ambassador cabled from Madrid that the Caudillo Franco had cleverly skirted around... What the fuck? On the 20th, the ambassador cabled from Madrid that the Caudillo, Franco, had cleverly skirted around the central issue. As to whether Spain would enter the war, there is no question. It is only a question of when. The German ambassador was instructed to read out to Franco 6 points which would do little for the dictator's vanity. The first point read, "Without the help of the Führer and the Duce, there would not be any nationalist Spain today, nor any Caudillo." If Franco did not abandon his vacillating attitude, then the end of the nationalist Spain was only a matter of time. Franco angrily denounced this as unjust. He had never vacillated. The ambassador cabled Ribbentrop that the Caudillo seemed more hesitant than before. Ribbentrop cabled him to see Franco and read out a message beginning, only the immediate entry by Spain into the war is of any strategic value to the Axis. This was the harsh truth. Given the necessary promise, Germany would at once release 100,000 tons of grain from Lisbon. On January 28th, Jodl put out to Hitler that it would be impossible to launch the actual assault on Gibraltar before mid-April, which meant that the hundreds of artillery pieces and troops involved could not be released for Barbarossa in mid-May. Hitler evidently still pinned some hopes on Mussolini's talks with the Caudillo on February 12th. A few days beforehand, he wrote the Caudillo a personal letter suggesting that in times of crisis, nations could be saved less by prudent foresight than by a bold heart. On the 14th, Ribbentrop telephoned to the Berghof a message from the Duce. Franco had made it abundantly clear that Spain would not join the war. Spain was to be granted the whole of French Morocco, and the assault on Gibraltar was to be executed by Spanish forces, perhaps with German support. Walter Hill wrote in his diary that day, "The Führer is going to drop Spain. They will just go under." In the evening, we sat for a long time with the Führer around the fireside. Continued Hill's diary, "The Führer talked about his pension, that of a middle-grade civil servant. He is going to write books, a third volume of Mein Kampf." Earlier that afternoon, he had spent 2.5 hours nervously trying to persuade the Yugoslav Prime Minister to join the Tripartite Pact. Hitler suggested that it was illusory to expect the British to evacuate their foothold in Greece now. Only when our dive bombers and armored corps appear will they get out of Greece as hastily as they have on every other occasion that we employed these means. Germany has no demands whatever against Greece. Here, as elsewhere, Britain is the root cause of all difficulties. And there's an asterisk here, so let's check it out. Had Italy not attacked Greece, the difficulties would not have arisen, but Huell was echoing his master's views when he wrote to a friend on January 23, 1941, "It is actually regrettable that we are forced to smash and destroy so much that we do not want to smash and destroy, and that should not have been destroyed for European culture and the mastery of the Germanic races." And that's all of the asterisk note. When the Yugoslavs left the Berghof, they said they would report to the Prince Regent in Belgrade and let Hitler know. On the outcome would depend Merida, and Hitler had reason to be nervous. The first wave of divisions was now moving toward the frontier with Russia, only a slow procession as yet. Not until mid-1941 would the second wave begin. As Lossberg had pointed out, the German railway network was so superior to the Russian system that when the real race began, Germany could muster 7 divisions a day and the Russians only 5. Farther west, the Barbarossa divisions waited, the better. The bigger will be the Russian surprise when the German troop concentration begins. When Field Marshal von Bock reported to Hitler on February 1st, their conversation ranged across the attack on Russia. Bock agreed that if the Russians stood their ground and fought, they would be defeated, and he wondered whether they could be forced into an armistice. This might be one consequence of the German capture of the Ukraine. Moscow and Leningrad, replied Hitler. Otherwise, the Wehrmacht must advance toward Yekaterinburg. Okay. Anyway, he concluded, I am glad that we carried on with arms manufacture so that we are now strong enough to be a match for anybody. We have more than enough material, and we already have to begin thinking about converting parts of our industry. Our Wehrmacht manpower position is better than when the war broke out. Our economy is absolutely firm. The Führer rejected out of hand any idea of yielding. Not that Bock had hinted at it. I am going to fight, he said, and I am convinced that our attack will flatten them like a hailstorm. 2 days after field, or 2 days later, Field Marshal von Brauchitsch brought the Chief of General Staff Franz Halder to the Chancellery to outline the Army's operational directive on Barbarossa. Although Army intelligence believed the Russians might have as many as 10,000 tanks compared to their own 3,500, the Russian armored vehicles were a motley collection of obsolete design. Even so, surprises cannot be ruled out altogether, warned Halder. As for the Russian soldier, Halder believed the Germans were superior in experience, training, equipment, organization, command, national character, and ideology. Hitler naturally agreed. As for Soviet armament, he was something of an expert on arms production, he said, and from memory he recited a 10-minute statistical lecture on Russian tank production since 1928. Hitler approved the Army's directive, but once again he emphasized the capture of the Baltic coast and of Leningrad. The latter was particularly important if the Russians were falling back elsewhere, as this northern stronghold would provide the best possible supply base for the second phase of the campaign. Hitler knew that Halder had just had a first round of talks with his Finnish counterpart, General Erich Heinrichs, in Berlin. He was convinced the Finns would make ideal allies, although Finland's political strategy would be problematical as she wished to avoid a complete rupture with the United States and Britain. As he said to his staff, they are a plucky people, and at least I will have a good flank defense there. Quite apart from which, it is always good to have comrades in arms who are thirsting for revenge. With the third wave in mid-April, continued Halder, the maximum capacity transport plan could begin. would begin, and the troop concentrations could no longer be concealed except as a vast decoy operation to distract from the invasion of Britain. But when the fourth and final wave of panzer divisions had been re-equipping and resting in central Germany started rolling eastward from April 25th onward, an invasion of Britain would become an obviously impossible cover story. Hitler admiringly agreed with all that Halder had said. When Barbarossa gets going, the whole world will hold its breath. It won't move a muscle. Probably no major campaign has ever been launched upon scantier intelligence. The services had furnished their lower commands with only the most adequate information on the Russians. Maps were non-existent. The Russian aircraft industry was an unknown quantity in which the veil was only gradually being lifted. Recent indications were that it was being expanded at a disconcerting speed. Goering was apprehensive that the Russian Air Force might prove more formidable than the Army intelligence figures indicated. While Halder had confidently advised the Führer on February 3rd that they would face only a small Red Army superiority in numbers, 155 divisions, by early April that figure had been raised to 247 divisions. 4 months later, when it was too late to retreat, the Army admitted it had now identified 360 Soviet divisions in combat with them. Fuck. The whole of Hitler's strategy was based on the assumption that Russia would be laid low in a blitzkrieg of only a few months. Now, on February 8th, Keitel learned from his staff that while the Luftwaffe and Navy would have enough fuel to last until the coming autumn, gasoline and diesel fuel for the Army's tanks and motor transport would not hold out beyond mid-August, unless, of course, the oil fields of the Caucasus could be reached in time. The rubber supply situation allowed for even less leeway. Much of Goering's rubber supplies had reached her from the Far East along the Trans-Siberian Railroad. War with Russia would cut that link, leaving only an uncertain trickle supplied by blockade-running ships. Later in February, the OKW submitted to Hitler and Goering a full survey of the economic side effects of Barbarossa. Keitel's economics expert General Thomas noted after meeting Goering on February 26th, "He shares the Führer's opinion that when German troops march into Russia, the entire Bolshevik state will collapse, and that for this reason we need not fear the destruction of the stores and railway system on a large scale, as I do. The main thing is to get rid of the Bolshevik leaders rapidly, first of all." Goering's anxiety about the weakness of the German supply lines. Goering's anxiety was about the weakness of the German supply lines. He recalled that supply failures had proved Napoleon's undoing. For this reason, he has kept urging the Führer to concentrate more on supply organization and less on activating fresh divisions, some of which would not come under fire. Hitler, however, was already thinking beyond the end of Barbarossa. On the 17th, Jodl instructed his staff that the Führer wished them to study the problems of assembling troops in Afghanistan for an assault on India. On Sunday, February 16th, Hitler's chief Wehrmacht adjutant Rudolf Schmundt had flown to North Africa with Rommel the week before, reported back to the Berghof with photographs of Rommel's arrival and a first analysis of the position. Not surprisingly, Hitler awaited Rommel's operations feverishly, as Schmundt wrote a few days later. Colonel Schmundt described to him the enthusiasm with which Rommel had thrown himself into his task. Hitler sanctioned all his requests for anti-tank guns, mines, and Luftwaffe reconnaissance and close support aircraft. Rommel's first troops had covered the 350 miles to the Italian front west of El Agheila in 26 hours. Before he left Tripoli, he set in train the rapid manufacture of scores of dummy tanks mounted on Volkswagen chassis to dupe the British into thinking he had a powerful armored force. The letters Rommel sent to Schmundt exuded optimism from every line. Hitler decided to send out the 15th Panzer Division as soon as he could. In mid-March, Rommel reported to Hitler in person and then returned to Africa. Without waiting for the new armored division to arrive, and against the explicit instructions of the Italian Supreme Commander, Italo Garibaldi, this German general launched a bold assault in early April. He did not halt until he had reached the Egyptian frontier and taken 3,000 British prisoners, including five generals. By the end of February 1941, the last major crisis before Barbarossa had been overcome, or so had been overcome, or so Hitler believed. At 7 a.m. on February 28th, since Greece still proudly refused to offer peace terms to Italy, the German Wehrmacht began throwing her three big army bridges across the mile-wide, fast-flowing Danube from Romania into Bulgaria. After several false starts, Hitler dictated to Fräulein Wolf an important letter assuring Turkey's President İsmet İnönü that he saw no reason, either now or in the future, why Germany and Turkey should ever be enemies. There's an asterisk for that. Fräulein Wolf's shorthand pad with the letter to İnönü would be found by American soldiers raking through the ruins of the Berghof in 1945. Germany and Turkey should ever be enemies. İnönü replied calmly, and Hitler was well pleased. On March 1st, we find Hitler in Vienna, where the German-speaking King Boris had authorized his Prime Minister Bogdan Filov to sign Bulgaria's formal entry into the Tripartite Pact. Within 1 week, the first German soldiers would be standing on the Greek frontier, facing British and Greek troops just as they had in 1918. This time things would surely be different. Neither Turkey nor Russia would move a muscle against them. I believe that's the end of the chapter. Yes. All right. Get that uploaded for you guys and be back soon.